Welcome to the Fab Four Free For All.
Not the.
No, it is the.
Welcome to Fab Four Free For All.
No, I'm sorry. Put the die in. Yeah.
Welcome to the Fab Four Free For All.
That was okay.
And welcome to another edition of the Fab Four Free For All. My name is Rob Leonard, and I am your moderator for today. And joining me, as always, is Tony Triguardo.
Hiya, folks.
And Mitch Axelrod.
I thought he forgot your name. Hi, how are you?
How can I forget Tony's name?
Well, and Triguardo. Try saying that three times
fast. I'm Italian. I'm half Italian.
Half Italian? What, the half that eats?
No, half Italian, the other half is Irish, baby.
Oh, my Lord.
And joining us today, all the way from Chicago,
a hell of a town.
Author Richard Buskin, who is the author of Beatles 101, The Need to Know Guide, published by Parading Press.
I love the inside joke in that, by the way.
And Richard, welcome to the Fab Four Free For All.
Hi there.
Oh, boy.
Oh, God.
He's starting right away.
It just started, didn't it?
Now, for most of you, you have to tell them, Rob, that most of you will have heard Richard on the Fab Four Free For All before.
Yes, because he was part of our show when we were at the fest.
Yes.
When we did our little panel with us three and Richard and Alan Kozin and Mark Lewison. It was a great, great show.
Yeah.
And we got a lot of great feedback from that show. That was a pretty packed show, too.
Yeah. You know,
wasn't that the show, though, that was moderated by a guy from Liverpool?
Yes, it was.
Yes.
Did Tony dare to do a British accent?
Yeah, I think at some point I may have even done a shut up while he's talking. Like, I think I even threw in like some bad Leninism.
That was a Yoko, right?
Yeah, nice.
So Richard,
more English than the English.
Richard, who has a real British accent, and Tony, who has a
non-British accent.
A weird British accent.
Here's what we're going to do. For this phone call, I'm going to go back to the Bronx. I'm going back to my childhood. This is it now for the whole rest of the show. So you guys deal with it.
You don't even do that accent well.
Nice.
Oh my God, and you're going to primal.
And I'm going to primal. Right?
Can you just do the Newtopian anthem and just
I'm going to do the Newtopian national anthem.
And we should say in the podcast world that Richard is also doing a podcast with Robert Rodriguez, our friend also.
Absolutely.
What's the name of that? Give a little plug for that, Richard.
Something About the Beatles.
But what's the name of the thing?
Yeah, what's the name of it?
Nice try.
Well, no, I was... that's a cue for you to say it again.
Yes.
So people... Oh, are you new to this or what? Come on.
Beatles.
And
Something About the Beatles.
Where can that be found?
It can be found on the Something About the Beatles website.
Cool.
And the URL?
www.somethingaboutthebeatles.com.
So now you're just getting redundant.
Well.
And I have heard, no, I haven't really heard it, I'm sorry. But I have heard that it's very good. It's not every week, right?
No, it's not. It's about every 2 weeks.
Okay, good.
Cool.
But we know Robert. We've had him on the show. We know Richard from being at the fest. And I'm sure it's a blast from what I've heard. It's really good. And as far as your podcast, how long is each show?
Roughly about an hour, although the next one's coming in a bit over that mark, but is usually about an hour.
Okay.
And what's the next one about, so when people can hear it?
The next one is about Beatle vocals. We listen to a lot of the isolated vocal tracks from...
Oh, that's a good idea. Let's steal
Beatles
that idea. Oh, I'm sorry. I shouldn't have said we're going to borrow that idea.
No, I wanted you to let him...
So you've gone through the Rock Band tracks, Richard?
Yes, we listened to a lot of those. And,
cool.
It's really fascinating stuff because it had me listening to the Beatles in a whole new way. You know, it just gave me a new perspective on their talents.
That's what seems to be, for us, I think, one of the most enjoyable things about doing the podcast, because you find yourself, I feel, sort of
rediscovering a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah. And also with, if you think about Rock Band, when it first came out, it was like, oh, what's this all about? But then, as scholars and fans, you actually start to go through the tracks and the Moogs and whatever they are, and it's like, wow.
Yeah.
You forget about the game part. No, everyone's forgotten about the game part now. It's like,
Is gone.
Yeah, and we're like, oh my God, so you can hear the vocal or you can just hear the guitar part or whatever.
Yeah.
It's really cool.
And it's funny because the game literally is now gone.
Yeah.
I mean, and the company is now gone.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, Harmonix, I believe, is gone.
Oh, okay.
But they disbanded because they had high hopes for the Beatles Rock Band and it didn't do well.
Right.
As well as they would have hoped.
Because you only have so many geeks who
still want to take it and put it on their computers and rip apart the tracks.
Well, but that's yeah. but that's the that is the lovely side, I won't say side effect, but the what you do get out of the whole yeah. game effort is that it is exactly what Richard's saying. Now you get to hear all the isolated stuff, which most people didn't even know existed
or cared about.
Or could isolate, but now it was done for you. So, but we have a book to talk about.
You know, it's not just about, you know, hearing little interesting bits where you hear, for instance, Paul humming the guitar solo to something during the break when they're listening through the headphones. But it's also just hearing the effort that really went into those vocals. I never realized until I heard the isolated vocal track how George is really belting something.
Oh, yeah.
You know, especially the bridge section. He's really belting it. It's an amazing vocal.
Well, the whole thing is that the song is so big in itself that you tend to forget that the vocal is not the real soft little vocal that you imagine him doing.
Yeah,
you know, and that's the thing. When you hear the isolated stuff, you have to realize that these guys were really trying, especially George. Yeah.
And even when you hear the harmonies, too, isolated. I mean, you know, for years playing in cover bands and doing Beatles stuff, we sort of would, I guess in a way, like fudge it. You know, you do it so you'd get it to sound similar to the record, and you have three parts doing what they do. But then I started working with Andrew Lubman on a couple of different dates. I don't know, Richard, if you've ever seen Andrew's stuff, but there's a site called allyouneedislub.com.
Okay, yes, yeah.
And Andrew would sort of deconstruct the harmonies with us, and we'd be mind blown over the fact that we were, quote, doing them wrong. You know, because you'd hear the parts. So you must have really gotten off on hearing you hear the harmony parts. It's amazing.
Well, so. Yeah, I mean, again, we always knew about Beatles' fantastic harmonies, but hearing the Abbey Road ones at a time when we know there was so much bitterness between the various group members, and yet once they're around that vocal mic, they're brothers in the studio.
Yeah,
you know,
it all goes away.
It's fantastic stuff to hear.
They knew what they were doing. Still.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
And the other thing is Paul's contribution with high harmonies, track after track after track, right the way through their career. Fantastic high harmonies by Paul.
Right.
Yeah, and it's funny because now when you hear it, you know, he does the low part of Two of Us when he sings now. It's like, don't do that.
And you laugh, too, because a lot of those harmonies that you thought might have been Linda in the solo records turned out to have been Paul.
Yeah.
But anyway,
Richard, let's get to the book.
There's this book.
This book called Beatles 101, The Need to Know Guide. There's a lot of things in it. I mean, in the sense that there's chapters that could have been whole books, and you sort of had to make it a concise chapter. Yeah, distill a lot of stuff. What was your thinking about doing a book like this compared to maybe an overall story about the Beatles, per se?
I just thought, you know, it's great to have a book. You've got Mark Lewisohn's book, obviously, which I think is unrivaled and will remain unrivaled. This is the easy-to-read, concise version of the whole story, and it's broken down in, I think, an unconventional way in terms of, you know, it's not done just purely chronologically.
Which we
basically
love.
Right, good, okay. So, you know, what I've tried to do here is tackle things by category. So whether it's a chapter about their voices or about their personalities or about the film and TV appearances, you know, I've broken it down into those sort of categories so that people can basically, if they want to read the book cover to cover, they can. But if they want to just access a particular aspect about the Beatles, they can also do that, just dip in and go straight to it.
And there are a lot of instances, which is great, where you say, you know, sort of, okay, well, more on that later. But for now, but the thing that, you know, as someone who's like written some articles and things like that, when you approach a book like this one, Richard, what do you sort of assume that the reader's going to already know when they pick up a book like a 101, because it's the Beatles and there's been so much exposure, you know, to them worldwide? What do you kind of assume as the starting point? Someone coming into the book, what do you think to yourself? Okay, they already probably know this. So where am I starting from?
Yeah, well, that's a good question, because with a book like this, I'm trying to reach as broad an audience as possible, but that means people at all different knowledge levels, including some people who I'm assuming know very little. They just know the basics of the group. You know, a lot of Beatle people out there love the music, haven't read a whole lot about the Beatles. And so on the one hand, I'm trying to make it that it's not too highbrow for them to be able to follow the story. On the other hand, not lose that readership who do know about the Beatles.
Right.
So the way I've tried to deal with that is by telling the whole story, and it's the whole story that a lot of people already know, but throwing in extra information that I feel that even fairly knowledgeable people don't know. Right. And one example is, you know, at the end of the book where I've got, I think, 7 interviews with Beatles record producers, recording engineers.
Just great.
Yeah, which takes you into the studio, and I'm sure there's some information in there, or some quotes at least, that even, you know, Beatle experts haven't read before.
Yeah, absolutely. Really, really
enjoyable.
That
was one of my favorite parts.
Yeah. Great, great
set. No, but what's really cool, I mean, you've written so many books, and actually this one is really an update of a book that you already had out, correct?
Yes.
You want to?
That was from the late 90s. It was The Complete Idiot's Guide to the Beatles.
Right.
Not my title. That was a series of books like Dummies Guides.
Right.
The thing with that, though, was it really was, you know, geared for people who knew nothing.
Right.
So it was almost basically, you know, saying things like, well, John Lennon played rhythm guitar, and, you know, it really was going right back to the basics.
Yeah, it was a once upon a time. Once upon a time.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it also had a kind of humor running through it that was geared towards that series that wasn't really my kind of humor. So I tried to give this a bit more edge and yeah, really not make it just geared purely towards the novices.
Well, right. You know, and that's what I really like about this, because as, you know, I consider myself sort of a, not an expert, but, you know, I do know a little bit about the Beatles, and...
You're an expert, Mitch.
Thank you. I appreciate that. The check will clear. But when you read this, there are certain little things that I found myself saying, wow, I didn't know that. Sort of like the old Python, you know, well, I don't know that. Exactly. And many of those things. And also, I love, getting to know you a bit at the fest. Lord help me. I got to know your humor a little bit.
Yeah.
And your humor is...
Oh, and I certainly got to know yours as well.
I'm sorry
there
to hear that.
There is none.
Well, thank you. Right. I appreciate that. But I was intrigued. A lot of the stuff in here has your humor, which I really enjoy. I mean, even the little titles like From Keller to Cellar.
Right.
But there was one part that I particularly, on page 194 about the Beatles cartoons, I don't know why I would look at that one, but... Even though my book wasn't mentioned, but that's okay.
Beetle tunes.
Yeah, if you say that three times, Michael
like
Keaton.
He's getting all his digs in here, folks.
Yeah, Michael Keaton comes out if you say Beetle tunes 3 times fast. It's so funny because you say it shot straight to the top of the U.S. television ratings and remained there throughout its first season, aside, that is, from a brief period of shame when the Baseball World Series pushed it into second place. I mean, that's so funny. I mean, if you don't laugh at that while you're reading, then you're missing the point. This is not going to be the encyclopedia of Beatles. It is going to be a great, great starting point and beyond, because I'll tell you, I didn't know, and I think we should get into it, where, first of all, I didn't realize, and maybe I should have, that in 1967, all 4 Beatles and Brian Epstein, which we now call him Brian Epstein, had signed the petition to legalize marijuana.
Right.
Yes.
I didn't know that. I just didn't.
Okay.
Maybe I missed it. But now I know it, and now I understand where Paul comes from.
Well, you were too stoned to see it.
Well, thank you.
Sorry.
Well, you weren't supposed to say that.
Sorry.
And I want to talk about this a little bit. A lot of the films that they were supposed to do, this threw me, because everybody always knows about Up Against It and the Three Musketeers, but you really...
See, I didn't know about the Three Musketeers.
I didn't know about the Three
Honestly,
Musketeers.
I did not know.
I knew about
Richard's book was the first time I read
the Lord of the Rings idea, but I didn't know about the rest of them.
Well, the Lord of the Ringo, as you've seen the movie posters now, you know. but can we talk a little bit in depth about stuff like that?
We most certainly can.
Because there's a lot of good material that I think, and don't give it all away because we obviously want people to buy the book, but there's some really cool titles that even before A Hard Day's Night, the Beatles were thought about.
So the Yellow Teddy Bears.
That was mind-blowing. I didn't know about that one either.
Right before the submarine, they were the teddy bears.
Nice. Right before they got the submarine, they were the teddy bears, apparently. Sorry.
Wow.
Anyway.
Yeah,
but that would have been a real cheap exploitation flick.
Sort of like Go-Go Mania?
The Beatles, Yeah, I mean, the concept of the film, I think, is about girls losing their virginity and having to wear a yellow teddy bear to
like
show that they had. Yeah, great concept.
And, wow. Yeah, for 1963.
Yeah, and this is early 63, okay, when, you know, they were basically just taking off in Britain. And they were already looking at film projects, it turns out, which is amazing. So this was going to be like a quickie. They didn't agree to it because their music basically was going to be published by whoever made the film. Right. So they were going to like lose the rights to music. But it's also really difficult to believe that they would have even gone through with that, because if you look at, you know, the Beatles' career, they always had quality control.
Yes.
You know, and yeah, right from the beginning, and with Brian there as well, of course. And it's really difficult to imagine them just going into a quickie exploitation flick.
Yeah, well, there probably would have been quickies involved, but probably more probably backstage.
And a lot of yellow teddy bears.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. But you know, I don't think it's a coincidence that they ended up making a quality film like A Hard Day's Night. You know, as I said, they were very, very careful about who they got involved with. And they were always looking at artsy-type films. That's why they loved Dick Lester.
Well,
so yellow teddy bears, I don't think so.
Well, most people don't even know, at least here, in the U.S., obviously in the U.K. it was more prevalent knowledge, but most people don't know that obviously A Hard Day's Night was thought about prior to them being on The Sullivan Show,
right,
because they were filming in March. So, I mean, they only
Absolutely.
Came here in February, so this was, you know, planned astutely.
Yeah.
Well, by them over in the U.K., you knew about it, but here we found the Beatles really, let's just say, in February of 64.
Right.
And all of a sudden, their movie's out in July, and you're like, whoa, what was that? So for all of Brian's... all of Brian's faults in terms of business, I mean, you certainly could see where he did well by them.
The thing about the Hard Day's Night, just to go on a tangent, part of the reason...
we never do.
No. Well, part of the reason United Artists wanted it is because they wanted the soundtrack album in the United States. But if you think about it, when did they start to negotiate that? Was it before or after I Want to Hold Your Hand came out? You know, was it a quick contract?
I think it's after I Want to Hold Your Hand.
Yeah, that's right. But it's something that to think about, because, you know.
Yeah, so it all came together pretty quickly there.
Yeah, very quickly.
And again, though, isn't the timing amazing? Some of it planned, some of it not. Because if you look at 64, as you said, they hit the States, and then, wow, they've got a film ready to go, okay?
Right.
And that same year, films that were made in 1963, but perfectly for them, came out in 64, you've got things like My Fair Lady and Mary Poppins, both British settings.
That's right.
Yeah, and, you know, it tied in with that whole British craze of 64, and there was no way that people would have known that that was coming.
That's true.
Yeah, there was... Then later on, staying in that whole Shades of a Personality, that was another one that was mind-blowing,
that
too.
That, to me, is honestly that I wish it would have been made, because whether it would have been good or not, it would have been a totally different Beatle film.
The question would have been, would they have had the kind of dramatic chops to pull it off?
Yeah, would they have to act?
Right.
You know, it's one thing to play yourself.
With the right editing and direction, that's what you see of A Hard Day's Night, there aren't too many scenes where there are long takes,
there's
a lot of editing. And so the thing about Shades of a Personality that makes it particularly interesting for me, and should explain to the audience, that the concept was John would be the central character, but that he had a split personality.
Like Sybil.
And you have Paul, George, and Ringo playing various aspects of that personality.
Wow, that would have been interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, in 67, right?
Yes.
Now, what makes that project particularly interesting is that Walter Shenson would have been the producer. So he was the producer of Hard Day's Night and Help.
Right.
That means, again, there would have been the kind of quality control that, for me, didn't really exist with Magical Mystery Tour.
Right, wow.
But
that's
then,
very
a more
true.
Disciplined project.
But then we would have missed Ringo driving the bus.
Very nice. Hey, maybe that would have been one of his personalities. Would have been Ringo the bus driver. But you know, in all seriousness, not to be funny, but to have combined a concept like a film like that with the acid intake that was going on at that time would have really been intriguing to see what the hell the result would have been.
Well, don't forget, Peter Sellers is then in The Party.
Right.
Which is sort
of,
not that, you know, Shades of Personality, but that kind of movie was going on already. And would we have seen Magical Mystery Tour if Shades of a Personality came out, we wouldn't have.
I doubt it. Yeah.
So
I doubt it.
It. What a change in all of the Beatles' history, because obviously we get what we get from Magical Mystery Tour, but I had no idea about this title.
Yeah, I didn't know about it.
And there's others in here, too, that we should just say,
and
go,
Richard, without,
you know, get
without,
the book.
Without giving away too much of sources of information, was that from going back and digging through older magazines or older, where did that...
There's a combination. You know, there's also a book, The Beatles Movies.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, Roy Carr, I think.
Oh, and, oh right.
Wow, that's so, right.
It's got a picture of the Beatles on the tank from Help on the cover.
That's right. Yeah, so that's got a lot of information in there, and also, as you said, in magazines and newspapers.
Right.
Richard, there's a great, like, seven-page article that could have been a whole book, really, if you think about it, but you made it concise. You talk about the Beatles anthology and how it really starts way before, and you gave a nice history of how it just didn't happen, the start in 1990. It was going on for, like, 10 years or more. And actually, if you think about it, you start really with the Ringo album, and then go to Sid Bernstein, and then Bill Sargent. So would you want to talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, really, while the Beatles were still together, end of 69, early 70, there was talk of doing some kind of project, a retrospective of their career. And at that point, they started, like, literally looking for photos in the files and putting stuff aside. Then, once they did split up, that's in the 70s, Neil was sort of basically assigned the task of putting together some kind of documentary.
Chris O'Dell was helping out on that project too, I think.
That's correct. Yeah. And that was called The Long and Winding Road. And you know, I think there definitely was a cut of that, because I think that's what the anthology makers saw. And that was their starting point. So right through the 70s, there was, talk backwards and forwards about it. Nothing really happened. Then John died. And it was shelved until about the late 80s. And that's when they began reviving the idea. And it took them several years to basically get their acts together on it. Even when they were filming it, I know there was a lot of lots of disagreements, let's say, you know, and lots of re-editing.
Who'd have thought?
I know.
But they started filming in late 91 and 92, didn't they?
Yes, they did. And you can see that in anthology, can't you? Yeah. You see, you know, George go through different looks, basically.
Yeah.
Long hair, shorter hair, and...
Yeah. And also, I don't know if you guys have seen the director's cut of the anthology, right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, in there you see some of the stuff that was cut, them talking about Yoko, George giving way more description about his first LSD trips.
He actually gives the name of the dentist, I believe,
he does.
In that, where they cut it out of the release version.
One of the things when I was reading that part, Richard, is I was thinking I'd love to see the Long and Winding Road cut.
Yeah, I know.
I've never seen it. I don't think it's been floating around in the collector circle.
Yeah, I certainly haven't seen it.
It would be interesting. It'd be nice to see how Neil put it together as an insider.
Also, what their perspective was, let's say, in the 70s, how much they were prepared to tell right then.
Yeah,
sure.
And actually, you know what, though? We love speculating here, but...
Sometimes.
Right. Can you imagine, though, at that point, all four Beatles, because you do miss John in the anthology that was released, but all four Beatles talking about it from a fresh perspective as opposed to 30 years later.
Depending on how fresh. I mean,
did you
catch John at the Lennon Remembers period, or did you catch him at the Dennis Elsis period?
Well, no, I'm talking...
Where are you getting John?
But Long and Winding Road, I believe, was up to like 72.
Right.
If I'm not mistaken. So they had like an hour and a half, 90-minute cut in 71 or 2. So,
oh, my God.
Yeah. So
John,
I mean,
would have been on the rampage.
Oh, totally.
Well, yeah, but I mean, it would have been kind of cool, though, you would get... the humor in the anthology is where, you know, one will say there was 60,000, there was 70,000, and George says, I think there were 500,000 or whatever he says, laughing.
Yeah.
But, I mean, at that point, maybe that humor wouldn't have come through.
Well, and John would have said, and I resented performing for all of them.
But then again, maybe the Long and Winding Road, since we've never seen it, maybe there's not a lot of interviews in it. Maybe it's more just connecting, you know.
I think it is, I don't think they actually did interviews for it, from what I know. I think it was just Neil putting together lots of different pieces of film and kind of basically, you know, creating a skeleton for the real thing.
Now, can we talk about Neil a little bit?
Yeah.
Because well, hold on a second. Let's take a break and we'll go back and we'll talk about Neil Aspinall. Right after this, we're talking with Richard Buskin, author of Beatles 101, The Need to Know Guide, and we'll be back right after this.
Hi, everyone. Just wanted to let you know that besides Fab Four Free For All, each of the three of us are involved in our own individual projects. Mitch Axelrod's two books, Beatle Tunes, the only book about the cartoon Beatles show, and Little Billy and Baseball Bob, can be found through all of your good booksellers online, including Amazon.com, or if you'd like autographed copies, contact Mitch on Facebook.
And my buddy Rob Leonard has a great Beatles show that he's been doing for 20 years called Beatles Songs, and it's on every Friday night from 8 p.m. to 11 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And you can listen to it online. It's streaming at www.ncc.edu/WHPC. And also look for it on tunein.com.
And Tony Truquardo is the host of 4F, Free Format for Free, on WCWP 88.1 on Long Island. He's on every Monday from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. Eastern Time. And also at www.wcwp.org. Also available on TuneIn.com. And we're back here on the Fab Four Free For All. Our guest today is Richard Buskin, New York Times best-selling author, by the way. He is the author of Beatles 101.
Wait, is he the best-selling author the New York Times ever had? Or is he the New York Times
I wish.
We might have to call Alan Cozen. He can tell us.
I am so tempted to just say move over Buskin.
Right. Yeah. He is the author of Beatles 101, the need-to-know guy. Not the crap you don't need to know, but
what?
The
exactly.
need-to-know guy.
Who did write
Let's
that book?
Let's get to the real stuff.
Yeah, wait. I do want to know, was there ever a book called Beatles 100, the crap you don't need to know. Right? I mean, who wrote that book, and can we talk to them?
Jeffrey Giuliano.
Oh!
I'm glad you don't name names.
Wow! We take no prisoners here.
We take no prisoners.
Wow. But when you hear this podcast, it'll be, and it'll be all blurred out, you know. Who? Who?
Beautiful.
Does he even exist? Okay, go ahead. Let's keep going.
And it'll be a bit like Her Majesty. You just lop off the last note.
Exactly.
Wow.
Jeffrey Julia.
Exactly.
You just gave away most of it.
No, that's true.
All right. Let's talk about Neil Aspinall, because we were going to talk about him. You know, we all have different feelings about Neil Aspinall. I mean,
Mitch has actually met him.
Well,
Mitch
once.
Did meet him, I should
once.
Say.
Once. And my experience is different than everybody else's, because I was there for a different reason. So it's not fair. And I'm not. That doesn't mean I don't like the man. It's just dealing with business as opposed to being the protector of the legacy of the Beatles. That's a big job.
I think Neil was all business all the time.
Well, maybe. And
that way.
You know, it just, we don't really know. Let's face it, we do hear your accent, and you're from over there.
Over there.
Well, you know.
Over there.
Wait a minute, you're singing the U.S. thing, and I'm saying over there. That's not fair. I guess it is fair. But you obviously have a different perspective than the U.S. people. You know, and we've talked to Mark about this, but not obviously in depth, because Neil doesn't come into the picture until, you know, his fourth book, so in, you know, the year 3000. But anyway,
in the year 2525.
Thank you, Zager and Albie Evans. Actually, I'm feeling like I'm from 2525 at the moment. But as far as Neil goes, you know, you talk about him a lot in the book. What is your feeling as a British person who really got to know him a little more than we obviously did over here?
I only met him once. I just introduced him, so I didn't know him.
But I mean, when I say know him, I don't mean personally. I mean
right.
know him in the fact of...
There was a higher public profile of him over there.
In the UK.
Right.
Not a whole lot, believe it or not, actually.
Really?
You know, he was very happy to remain in the background, Neil. You know, you can see that in his persona. That ran right through his life. I mean, we're not talking another Paul McCartney. We're talking about a guy who's very happy to be at a low level. So I don't think most people in the UK, you know, certainly the general public wouldn't know who Neil Aspinall was.
Why is that? Because, you know, I was very happy that they included him in the anthology for obvious reasons, but the anthology was really the first time we ever got to see him. I mean, really
I
see him. I mean, other
I
than driving the van, you know, back in the pictures in 16 magazine and all that garbage. But really see Neil and get his perspective on things. And you almost wish, and I know Mark has discussed that, you know, he was a good friend of Neil, why he wouldn't disclose, you know, or have a book out by Neil. And I appreciate that. But would, you know, Neil was really the protector of the legacy of the Beatles.
For me, Neil would have been the ultimate storyteller on the Beatles. I mean, he was the fly on the wall. He was there. Right. He was there, you know, right from the beginning. Well, say the beginning, but, you know, early 60s.
Yeah.
And basically right the way through to the end. And he was in the hotel rooms with them, in the dressing rooms, driving the van. Neil saw it all. So he would have brought the objectivity that we don't get with anthology, where the Beatles are telling their own story. You know, Neil would have been able to tell, they say warts and all, that this would have been the warts and all story.
But he has such a nice demeanor in the anthology. He just has a very soft-spoken...
Yes.
He's not, you know, he could have been...
A hard guy. When I was introduced to him, you know, he just basically gave me the once-over. He looked me up and down. You know, he wasn't particularly friendly. He's a hard scouser. Like they were, you know. Let's not forget that in the early days, he was the guy having to load gear in and out of the van with a bunch of hard Teds, you know, eyeing all of the equipment.
Right.
And he was on his own doing this stuff. He had to be a hard knock, as John would say, to even do that job.
Well, he also had the wall up, you know, for the Beatles. He had that wall up, I guess, against people like you and me and whoever else was trying to... You know, I'm not going to say capitalize on the Beatles, but try to get in there.
I always thought from anything I read on him, especially like in the 80s and late 70s, that he was there to sort of get back the money they didn't get in the 60s almost, where he was blocking anything from being used unless it was for a huge amount of money, where maybe it could have been used.
Let's face it, for the longest time, Apple, you know, in the 70s and as you say, the 80s, Apple seemed to largely exist just to litigate.
Yeah, really,
that's all
true.
It was doing. You know, in recent years, it's been putting out product, but you know, back then, that's all they really did do is, as you said, say no, have Neil saying no to things and suing those who ignored that no.
Call the wife, sue the wife.
Right, just right out of the ruggles.
Go home, call the wife, sue the wife.
You know what?
He was an amazing. I mean, he was someone that they could rely on. 100%. If you look at the people that they got involved with, whether it was Klein, who did his thing and still ripped them off, you know, or George with Dennis O'Brien, you know, Neil was that guy who they knew from the beginning, they knew they could rely on him. And they could rely on him not only to look after their best interests, but to never sell them short, never go to the press, as you said, you know, with his story.
Yeah.
He was loyal right the way through.
And interestingly, too, you know, obviously you talk in the book about Neil's relationship with Mona Best.
Yeah.
And, you know, you have to wonder if that crossroad moment.
We should say they had a child together.
They had, right. Neil and Pete Best's mother, Mona, had a child together, Rogue Best. And
what a name that is.
Yeah.
Don't go there.
You know, ain't that the truth? But and it doesn't fit his personality at all. But, but dear Rogue. But the thing is, there had to be some sort of sign of the loyalty there when it came down to it. You know, Neil, even after the Beatles dismissed Pete, you know, Neil stayed with them. You know,
astounding.
And yeah.
Neil stays with them. He's still with Mona.
Yeah.
He's still, you know, going to Heyman's Green.
Yeah.
I think Ringo's kit at some point is even stored there. And it kind of undermines everything we hear, doesn't it? You know, about all the enmity between the Beatles and the Best.
Right.
And yet, yeah, there's this weird kind of crossover here with Neil in the middle of it all. Again, they're just unique personalities. They don't live the way we would.
Nope.
They could have sacked Neil for his indiscretion, couldn't they?
Well, you have to wonder how Brian handled that. I mean, we never really talked or heard much about how Brian handled that little bit of controversy.
I think they just kept it quiet.
I guess
people in Liverpool probably knew about it, but you know, the rest of the world.
And it's stunning that it goes right through the 60s. That, you know, you've even got that memento on the cover of the Sgt. Pepper album, which was something that Mona gave.
Right.
To,
right.
You know, yeah, I mean, it's just
yeah,
amazing.
It is ironic. When did you move to the States?
I moved to the States in September of 1995. I moved to L.A. initially.
Okay, so...
Right at the anthology coming on.
Absolutely, yes. I was there, actually, just to see it when it debuted on TV.
The one thing I wanted to ask you now is you do have a, because it's obviously part of the Beatles' history, is the whole Paul is dead issue.
Yeah.
Now, you do have it. Obviously, there's books on that as well. You give a good, very concise couple of pages on it, which is fine. But it's a very U.S.-centric rumor.
Yes.
So As a person who was from the UK and then having to write about it, how does that fit into the history over there?
Right. Well, it is. As you said, it's very US-centric. The British perspective on it, if I'm going to generalize, would be regarding the Americans would be, here they go again, you know, some absolutely wild rumor. It was never as overblown there as it was, you know, over here, without a doubt. So when I'm writing about it, internally there is this sort of skepticism about how the whole thing just had a life of its own.
But you have to sort of speculate a little bit and say that, I mean, there's no denying that there are certain clues, and I'm not saying the death clues, but there are certain clues that the Beatles gave us that they may have been involved with some of the clues after they, well, it's 1969.
Yeah.
But I mean, there's certain songs, you know, The Walrus Was Paul, I Told You About Strawberry Fields, and I mean, there's so many different things that, how did they do?
Silly American.
Yeah, no, I know, I am sorry.
I mean, The Walrus Was Paul, John explained that in the 1970, not in the 1970 Unwanted interview, later on,
yes.
I think he said that he was just, it was just being nice. I have Yoko, and I'm just trying to give him a gift in song here.
Yeah. But
unless also, too, there was the explanation that he may have realized that the walrus was not necessarily the good guy.
Maybe he finally realized it,
and
you know,
was
about the walrus and the carpenter.
That the walrus is not necessarily the good guy. So maybe it was, and here's another clue for you all, The Walrus Is Paul, passing it off that way. Who knows?
I think there's also, there's subliminal stuff that even he may not have been aware of. I mean, for instance, do you believe that Lucy in the Sky of Diamonds was based on that painting that Julian brought home from school?
I do.
But at the same time, I think it's hard to believe that acid, LSD, didn't play some role in the writing of and recording of that song.
Sure.
Right. And did John realize it after the fact when he titled it and had a giggle over it?
Yeah.
You know, who
very
knows?
Very possibly. But it's very possible.
But he was on, what, the DiCavett show when he was talking about it? When he seemed so sincere when he said, you know, I'm looking and it says LSD and I had to go through every song and figure it does the word. But he did seem very sincere when he was saying that.
I agree,
So you sort of think, well, maybe people were just, you know, doing that because they thought he was dropping acid every 2 seconds.
Well, he was.
I know he was.
He was. I got a question for you.
You know, I mean, I've co-authored a lot of celebrity autobiographies, and it's amazing how many times they're telling me their story. And of course, I'm looking at it objectively, and I'll analyze something about their lives, maybe something about their work that was reflecting their lives.
Yeah.
And they'll be amazed. Oh, I never thought about it that way.
Right. Right.
And I think so that, you know, I think we have to kind of allow for that with the Beatles as well, that maybe not everything was preconceived.
Sure.
You know,
because there ends
some
up
stuff occurred after the fact.
There ends up being absolutely a psychology in putting together biographies. I imagine. I mean, you've done a number of different biographies, Richard, and you know, that's true. So in this instance, it's different because in a few of the biographies you've done, I imagine you interviewed the subjects, and it's different to write it, I guess, as an after-the-fact biography where you're compiling stories or verses when you're working either with living subjects or people who are, so I imagine two totally different approaches. Am I right?
Absolutely. Well, you see, I've done the one where it's the biography, like I did a biography of Sheryl Crow.
Right.
So that was all my writing, interviewing people. In the case of the autobiographies that I've written, where I'm writing it in the subject's voice, then I'm working with them. You know, then I'm actually interviewing them, meeting with them, and then writing in their voice.
Right.
So it's a completely different approach.
Sure. Richard, in the book Beatles 101, The Need to Know Guide, how many of the people you talk about are based on interviews you've had? And were they done specifically for the book, or were they done for other things and then you sort of pulled them out for the book?
Done for other things. I mean, all of the, obviously, the producer-engineer interviews are ones that I did, and then there are quotes throughout the book by various people, and, you know, quite a few of those are pulled from my own interviews.
I want to talk a little bit about the artwork because...
Eric Cash
is very talented. I want to let you talk about him a little bit because the cover is astounding. It's beautiful. It's very eye-catching.
I thought this was a real picture when
did you when you first glanced
when you guys gave me when Mitch gave me the book. Go, oh, great picture! I never saw that angle. And then It's like, oh, that's Richard Cash.
No, Eric Cash.
Eric Cash. I'm sorry, Eric Cash.
Well, that's the remarkable thing about it, is that he's taken the first Ed Sullivan show and basically drawn it from a perspective that we've never seen, an aerial shot, basically looking down on the group. And it is. It's really stunning. It's eye-catching. And the thing I love about his artwork is, usually when I see, you know, Beatles artwork, it can be impressive, but I may look at it and think, you know, the eye is off there, or, you know, they look a little bit weird, or something lets it down.
Right.
And with Eric's artwork, some of it is almost hard not to believe that it's a photo. You know, some of it is so dead on. And he does adapt it from photos, but often he does what he calls Frankensteining, where he'll maybe put different photos together, or he'll even shoot himself. If I think there's a drawing of George in the book, for instance, Country Gentleman.
Yes.
He had the face from a photo, but the angle of the arm playing the guitar he didn't have, so he had photos taken of himself doing that. And then he adapted from that. So that's what he calls Frankensteining.
Yeah, and the backbeat picture is of Ringo from Washington. I have a canvas of that. Absolutely stunning, because you could see the wrinkles in Ringo's pants. And people who have seen it in my office think that it's a real photo.
Yeah, and it's those wrinkles in the pants that really attracted you to the photo, let's be honest.
The trousers.
It was the trousers.
Because they're very tight.
Yeah,
you see all the lines.
Outlines, everything.
but it is true, yeah. The detail that he captures is really pretty astonishing. I also love the photo in the beginning, which is of the first meeting between John and Paul.
That's
with
just
the quarry,
great.
You know, with the quarryman. And he adapted that from interviews that he did with the surviving quarryman, describing the scene.
Yeah,
because he got as much detail from them as he could, and then went ahead and did the painting.
Which is lovely, because, you know, as an author and a fan, obviously, your goal when putting a book like this together is to get the details right and to get the information right and to have the book tie with an artist who is doing the same was really a wonderful, wonderful idea.
And that's why also I interviewed Eric for the book, so that for every piece of artwork, which is a full page, on the facing page you have him talking about, you know, what the inspiration or the techniques that he used were for each individual painting.
And it's a lovely part of the book.
Yeah, really, by the way, we should plug that too by saying you can go to www.ericcashillustration.com, because he does other stuff other than the Beatles as well. So, but his Beatles stuff is really good. Quick question for you. When you do a book like this, obviously you're culling from a bunch of others, but you're also obviously from your own stuff and your own knowledge.
Yeah.
Well, a two-part question. Number one, is there something that you learn, even though it's a 101 type guide? And also, is there something you wish there was more on that you could, because we all are morons, but is there something more on a subject that you wish was out there that you could tell, such as maybe Eric Clapton's Wedding Jam?
Yeah, I actually would have liked even more information about what really went on behind the scenes during the making of Anthology, because I know that there was a lot of disharmony and disputes going on. So I would love to see that footage. I'm sure there's a load of footage.
Really?
That, you know, that would show them going at it. And,
well,
you know,
Ringo throwing the brick through Paul's window was, I'm sorry.
That was last week.
If you look at the extras in Anthology, the bit where they're sitting in Abbey Road in 95 with George Martin sitting at the console.
Yep.
And there's a moment there where you see the Beatles dynamic, even with three of them, which was always usually two or three would gang up on one. And in this case, you've got Paul sitting in the middle of George and Ringo. And there's a point at which George cracks a joke at Paul's expense. It's something, I think, something like who played bass on Tomorrow Never Knows.
Right.
And they can't remember who it is. And I think George says it sounds like Arthur Askey, who was like a British music hall comedian. And you see George laugh at his own joke, look across at Ringo, who smirks back, and Paul is just looking down at the floor. You know?
But I think, doesn't Paul at that point say something like, well, I think it's me?
Yeah, I know. But I can see that Paul is not exactly enchanted with that moment. Well, you know?
one of the things about the anthology, and you talk about in the seven-page article, part about the book, is if you look at Paul's quotes and interviews around that time, you can tell that he was being very careful not to piss George off.
Oh, yeah.
And very scared, you know, the fact that he used Jeff Lynne, the fact that George used this slide playing instead of, you know, more of a Beatle George Harrison guitar solo, that type of thing. He seemed very careful about how not to piss off George.
Yeah, and again, a repeating pattern, isn't it? We've seen that footage in Anthology from 1970, January 69, I should say, Let It Be, when they're discussing in the Apple office about going up on the roof.
Yeah.
And you can see there where George is saying, well, I don't really want to do this, but I'll do it if everyone else does it. And Paul is saying, well, yeah, let's not discuss it right now. You know, I don't want to cause tension.
Mm. Yeah.
So, you know, that kind of repeated it during the Anthology project because... In fact, when it came to publicizing it, George went to Australia to get away from the press.
Yeah, and that's the funny part. Right. You see a lot of, in the electronic press kits, you see his interviews and stuff, but it's really from the interviews. It's not specially done for this.
Right.
Richard, one of the things I loved about the book is you interview...
We love all of it, by the way.
Well, I know, but there's a great section where, starting with George Martin going all the way to Alan Parsons... you interview either, you know, obviously George being the producer, but all the engineers and second engineers on the Beatles stuff. And it was a nice little insight on how the records were made and the Beatles themselves. The only one that's not there is Ron Richards. I know he's only there for a couple. But
Yeah, that's right. But most of them are there, as you said.
Yeah.
And what I personally love with that is the different perspectives.
Yeah.
You've got some of them saying, oh, it was just a joy to work with the Beatles towards the end, even, you know, on you know, Ken Scott is saying, had absolutely no problems engineering the White Album. It was just a joy. And I think you have Glyn Johns, who was on the Get Back project, saying, yeah, they were just easy to work with. And then you have John Kurlander, who was an assistant engineer on Abbey Road, saying when just one Beatle was in the room, it was great. When two of them were together, it was good. When three of them were together, it got a bit scary. And when four of them were together, it was unbearable.
Yeah, that's a great thing.
And it's like, my God, you know, totally different perspectives from people who were there in the studio with them.
Interestingly, though, it's also the reality that you don't hear, which is that when four of them were there, it was really five of them.
Yeah.
I mean, let's be honest. I mean, and not to push
they had the bed. You know.
The bed, you're right. No, but not to push that. But, you know, you could imagine the fact that once it was the presence of all four, at that time, had to have been five.
Yeah.
You know, really.
But there are other pictures from Abbey Road where Linda's on the bed, too, because she was pregnant.
Yes.
You're right.
You know, so, I mean.
Right.
Are you talking about Yoko, or are you talking about the fact that four of them would equal, you know,
well,
another
person? Well, that's a metaphysical way to look at it. You're right. Four of them did equal the four-headed beast.
Right.
No, I think
but I'm
meant
talking
Yoko.
About meaning oh, Yoko. Yoko. Yeah. Yeah, okay. Absolutely.
But, you know, the question I just asked about, because you answered one part of it, but I want to get back to the first part of something you may have learned while doing it. And I do want to ask you one thing. You're very good friends with Mark Lewisohn. He's a great historian and obviously a great author.
And has been on our show.
Yes, a couple of times. Oh, yeah. But we have to plug those shows. Yeah, right. But the one thing I will say is I don't know the timing of everything, but you do mention Tune In a lot in this book, which is great because obviously it needs to be. But were you almost done with this book, and then Marx came out, and you went, "Son of a, you know, I have to redo this."
It was a bit like that. Well, don't forget, I read Marx's book quite a long time ago because I was reading the manuscript as he was writing it. He was sending me chapters, so I did get to see it. You know, I didn't see it when all you guys did, so I had that information, you know, ahead of time, to be honest.
Show off.
But, and again, what I wasn't going to do was just rip off all of his new information. That, you know, that would have been terrible.
Right.
The one thing I did do, though, I thought I can't leave out, was that he had come up with a whole new band name, J-Page 3.
Yes. Yeah, which was
from
right.
1959. And in the section where I talk about the evolution of the band's name, there was just no way I could leave that out. So,
right.
You know, I told Mark, I said, I'm going to be putting this in. He said, yeah, that's fine. But
other than that,
I had to, you know, be careful.
Other than that, was there anything that you found out
uncovered?
By doing the book again?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I didn't realize until I read about it while doing the book that in 1980, John gave a deposition because it was about the Beatlemania stage music.
Right, right.
That the Beatles and Apple were trying to shut down. And they didn't like the use of the word and so on. And John gave a deposition, I think it was in like November of 1980.
Yeah.
Where he gave this deposition in New York to some lawyer and basically said that, you know, they can't use this name and they can't be doing this show because it undermines plans for their own real Beatles reunion. And that he was going to be traveling to Britain. And it's like, okay, that was most likely said purely for legal reasons to try and shut down the show. But then there was a quote of Yoko's that I found where she said that John was planning to tour in 1981 and go back to the UK. And also there was talk of a Beatles reunion. Flies completely in the face of what John was saying in the interviews he was doing at that time.
Yeah.
But it was a bit of a mind blower when I came upon that.
And also, I don't know if you know this, but in Frederick Dannen's book, Hitmen, Paul McCartney, when he signed to Columbia, had a thing in his contract that said that if the Beatles were to reunite, Columbia could not stick their legal nose in to prevent them because technically they would be on Capitol, I guess, and Paul
right.
being on Columbia in the States. They couldn't stop them the way Amit Erdogan would do to Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young.
Right.
But that year was what, 1984 or 3?
No, 79.
Oh, I'm sorry.
78,
right,
whenever
right,
he signed,
right,
when he was on the contract.
So, you know, this
beforehand.
Must have been floating around.
Yeah, a little bit. Some,
because there were rumors. I mean, May Pang has said that, you know, John had talked about it. So it's amazing what could have been, isn't it?
It really is. And even Anthology, you know, we've got obviously a lot of John material in there. But can you imagine if John had been sitting in front of the cameras for Anthology?
Ugh.
You just know, even in nice guy mode, he would have, you know, dropped bombs all over the place.
I think, you know, in 1980, I think had come to the point where he became comfortable with the history of the Beatles and what he and that the fact that he was part of it. I think in 70 for the Jan Wenner interview for Rolling Stone, he was just angry at that.
It's too fresh.
He's angry at the world.
At the world and the Beatles and, oh, I became famous because I sold out and, you know, not because I was an artist. Well, he wouldn't have become famous from Two Virgins or Life with the Lions. No offense.
But still, look at the 1980 Playboy interview where they end up going through the Beatles song catalog
track
and
track.
Discussing the songs. And he certainly takes his shots at Paul there.
Yeah. But
he says, like, Yesterday, yeah, nice song, and I never wished I wrote it. Let It Be. I don't know what he's thinking when he writes a song like that.
But also, he did say that
he
wrote a lot
him.
Of songs. Together, eye to eye, which he didn't say in 70. So,
right.
Oh, absolutely. So.
Well, he does praise a lot of Paul's songs there. Well, not a lot.
For No One, I think he really liked.
Yeah.
Or
and Here, There, and Everywhere.
Here, There, and Everywhere. Yeah.
He knocked George
I think he was. John Lennon never gave a bad interview, let's put it that way. So, what he would have contributed to, you know, Anthology, I mean, it's hypothetical now, but you know it would have been gold again.
And
you know?
George Harrison also never gave a bad interview.
No.
At
I
least
agree.
In my eyes. I mean, out of all four of them, I think the best interview was George Harrison, and that's what I miss most about him. If you go on YouTube, there's one from Australia in 82 where he just goes, you know, he gives a very frank interview about everything. I think he wanted to, you know, let's just say, hit the bird, so to speak, but because she was very attractive. But I do think he was very insightful. So do you think that, again, so speculative, but I have to ask this question, would those four have talked about the Beatles now in 2014? I mean, really talked about the Beatles, or would it have been just passé to them?
I think they would have still talked about it,
I think so,
I do.
Too.
I don't think they could shake that, if you know what I mean. Even they would have known by 2014, if they didn't already know it by 1980, that they could never get this sort of monkey off their back. You know, this is going to follow them all their lives.
Yeah, they're
always. And I think they were coming to terms with that, and they would have certainly come to terms with that in 2014.
Yeah, I think so. I think George, when he toured, he does a lot more Beatles songs. Yeah. Yeah. Paul plays mostly Beatles songs now on tour.
I mean, when I first saw Wings, which was back in 76, the world tour, and it was Wings over Wembley in London, and, you know, it was like, wow, you know, I can't remember how long that show was, like 2.5 hours, and it was like Paul did 5 Beatles songs, and we were so grateful for 5 Beatles songs.
And now you wish he does more solo stuff.
Yeah, very much.
Oh, my God.
Richard,
by the way, that's something I don't know if you noticed in the book, because all the photos are ones that I took, and...
Yes.
There are a couple of Paul photos that have been unpublished before.
There's one of you talking with him and Linda at the very in 1988.
Oh, yeah, that's right. One outside Abbey Road one night.
Yeah, who took that?
Just a friend of mine, basically a guy called James Leasing. I'll give him a shout out.
There you go, James.
And,
I thought it was Father Guido.
He just happened to take a shot of me talking with Paul there. But there is a shot from the Take It Away video shoot in 1982.
Yep.
And
page 290.
Another one of Paul in, I think, 1989 in rehearsals for his world tour.
Yeah. I like that picture of Linda and Paul. Linda looks nice there. Now, with the picture of you and Paul and Linda, is this when the court order went out that you can't be near Paul for more than 100 feet?
I thought Father Guido Sarducci took that shot, actually.
Richard, you're obviously from Great Britain. Where did you grow up in Great Britain? And I'm just curious.
In London. Yeah, in North London, a place called Winchmore Hill, which is in North London. And then I lived in Hampstead. When I lived in Hampstead, that was... I don't know, 5 minutes around the corner from Abbey Road Studios.
Oh, wow. So hence that shot of Studio 2.
Yes.
That's one that you took, I imagine.
Absolutely, yep. Yeah. I used to be able, because I knew the people at Abbey Road, as well as at various other recording studios, so if I wanted to go in there, I could.
So did you have the privilege of doing the Abbey Road tour when that hit?
Yes, I did, yep.
How mind-blowing was that for you to hear the material? And
Because that was the first time. That was, I think you're talking about
83,
before they redecorated Studio 2.
Yeah, 1983.
That's correct, yes. I was there, and actually Mark was there as well, of course.
Right.
And, what was fantastic, I remember, it was the first time I heard Take One or the demo, whatever you want to call it, of While My Guitar Gently Weeps. Yeah.
Which I absolutely love, better than the released...
Yeah, so that was like mind-blowing for us because they had this sort of slideshow up on the screen and then they just played this over in the main speakers there. And that was kind of mind-blowing for everyone. It was also kind of sad that they were going to redecorate it, but that said, Abbey Road always looked so out of date. It did even when the Beatles were using it. You know, it was always behind the time. So it was kind of time for a change. But it was great to see it in its original form.
Well, they just announced they're redoing Abbey Road. They're going to update a lot of it. I assume they're not touching Studio 2, but they're going to have a lot more digital stuff in there. And there's going to be an analog room, I guess, to keep things going. But they've just announced it's going to be redone.
And after almost closing.
You know, you can still go down into the cafeteria in the basement, which is where you see shots of the Beatles in 62 and 63. You know, it's all still there. It's been, you know, shifted around and changed. But the main part of it is the same. And, of course, it looks exactly the same on the outside.
I want to just say one thing. As far as the book, you do give props to Chaz Newby.
Yes.
Now,
And not many people do. I mean, I know Jim Birkenstock.
Well, he's only there for 4 weeks. That's why.
Understood.
Still,
but
nice guy. We met him at the fest. Nice guy.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. But there's little pieces of info in this book and others. Mm. And I realize, you know, there's so many different books on the Beatles, thousands. We know that. But to take them and make a concise 300
distillation like this, which is what,
and that's why it makes sense.
Well, and that's why I was going to say, Richard, too. We talked a bit, quote, off air, but as a librarian, my other hat, you know, I have people that are constantly coming in and looking for books about specific topics. It's cool to know the kids are doing Beatles projects, Beatle modules in middle school, in high school.
Yes.
And one thing that is great is that it is hard to find a concise, all-encompassing, here's the story,
you know, kind of in a nutshell. And for that, I think I really
appreciate... Well, especially if you were just coming into their history.
Well, you're coming into their history, and it's also the idea, too, that...
You don't want something that's too...
Too intense,
because you're going to get lost.
But you also don't want to talk. You also don't want to talk down.
Right. I mean, you don't want it to be once upon a time. There were four men.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, we do have children's books and YA books. There's a YA Lenin biography that's very nice. But the thing that's also
young adult.
I'm sorry, I'm a library geek.
You are a geek.
But the thing that I appreciate too, Richard, is that there's humor in. You know, you bring in the controversial topics without. Dwelling on them per se, you bring in the drug use. Interestingly, you bring in two virgins.
Well, he doesn't bring in two virgins.
He brings in two virgins.
I'd buy more books if he did.
That was to help him write the book.
No, teddy bears there.
No teddy bears.
Just brown wrappers.
Just to help write the book, we brought in two virgins. But I mean, you know, the thing that I appreciate is that. And here's what's interesting about it. And
you didn't finish your sentence.
Well, here's, you know me, I'm jumping around.
Yes, you do.
You don't dwell too heavily on the music. You're not constantly dropping song titles. You bring up Abbey Road, you talk about the medley and how important it is, but you don't start ripping it apart and going to song. The music is going to essentially speak for itself.
Absolutely.
Which is a unique take, I think. You're telling the story. And you're telling it in a segmented way, and you're connecting the dots. You know, people say, well, there's not a lot of the music. No, but it's cool, because you're bringing in the idea of the music. Let the music speak for itself.
Yes.
Tell the story behind. So
absolutely. You got the point. I mean, that's exactly it. And you see, if I started getting into the music, I think the book would actually begin to lose focus. It'd be too much.
Too much.
And there are books that do that. And as you said, what I'm trying to do is get people, okay, listen to that again. Re-listen to it.
It's almost a companion to the idea of here's the catalog. Dig the music. Indulge yourself in the music. You want to know the story of the four guys that are making the noise and what happened to them along the way? Here's the story.
Have the music on in the background as you read the book.
Yeah, you bet.
Richard, a lot of the pictures you said in the book are ones you took, and there's a lot of them from Liverpool. Obviously, you went on the couple of tours, or you knew where to go at least. In Mark's book, he talked about how history has been destroyed, not just, I guess, in Liverpool, but in other places. As a person from Great Britain, what's some of the history you think has just been missed or killed along the way, from knocking down buildings and stuff like that?
Are you talking Beatles related or
just Beatles,
in a general sense?
Beatle related.
Yeah, Beatle related. I mean, quite a lot of the photos of mine that you see in there were taken in the late 70s.
Oh, okay.
So, for instance, I take a photo of Alan Williams standing on the side of where the cabin used to be, and it was just a pile of rubble. Now, that's, of course, all being changed there. So that's kind of gone the opposite way. However, there are places like, I'm not sure if it's Littleton Town Hall or I think it's Littleton that doesn't exist anymore. Yeah. And so I did manage to get some of these venues that no longer exist, which is, that's just a real shame. I went on a tour with my daughter a couple of years ago in Liverpool, did one of the bus tours, and some of the places just were no longer around. And even Liverpool itself, the center of Liverpool, for quite a few years now, it's like a big one-way system, driving system there.
Right.
And they gutted the city center. And so a lot of the Beatles' Liverpool just doesn't exist anymore.
The roundabout is different.
Yeah.
Yes.
Even. But to the positive, you also do have the Liverpool Institute now, which has preserved a few of the buildings that were very important in Beatles' history.
Absolutely. And they're merging the Art Institute with the Art College. And they're really preserving. However, inside, again, they're changing everything. I think as we speak, they're refurbishing it on the inside. Not that the general public, would be doing tours there, but it is getting changed. But at least the outside is still the same.
Right. Right.
Richard, when you went on the bus tour, like you said, do you listen to the guy giving the spiel and say, okay, he's got that right, he's got right there? Because that's what I did. That's exactly.
Oh, absolutely.
And I was with David Bedford on the bus, and I said to him afterwards, I go, David, he got everything right. He goes, of course. And then I find out later, the guy was joking. He goes, well, we get everything out of David's book anyway.
On the last tour I did, the bus was zooming along, and I just said to the guide, who was now taking a break at this point, I said to him, wasn't that Rosebery Street we just went past where, you know, we got the first shot of John with the quarryman? Yeah, I think it was.
Yeah, that's the ticket. It was.
And then a thought bubble over the guy said, oh, mm-hmm. I got one of these guys on the bus now, do I?
The Beatle geek
is here.
Something
we spoke about off air is from, I think, the 77 or 78, can't remember myself now, when I did the Magical History Tour in Liverpool. And that was, I think, the second Beatles convention in Liverpool to be staged.
Yep. Right.
Alan Williams and Bob Wooler were the organizers, which is just a fantastic memory now.
Wow. I would like to go drinking with those guys.
Oh, yeah, which I did.
Yeah.
It was an adventure. You know, we basically went on this tour, and it was like several buses. And my bus had Beryl Williams, Alan's wife, as the guide. Alan was the guide on another bus. And when we got to Hayman's Green, the home of Mona Best, Pete Best's mother, she was there to meet the fans. Really, she was very nice, spoke with everyone. There's a photo of her in the book, looking a bit mean and volatile, as Alan Williams described her in his book. And that was because he described her that way that he knew she wasn't going to be in a friendly mood for him, so he was actually hiding behind a bush while we were meeting with her.
Well, they were competitors in many
sure,
ways.
Sure. And you met someone along on that tour, didn't you, and didn't realize it at the time?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And there's a photo of that.
Yes. You know, I think you're referring to a certain author.
Yes.
Yes, and it's not me.
Yeah, there's a shot from, again, from, I think, 77, and we're standing in front of Strawberry Field. And as you look at the photo, at my left is a young guy with a whole array of badges on his sweater and his
geek.
Jacket. Oh, yeah, total Beatle geek. And he was someone who I was about to become friendly with, hadn't yet, so it's a coincidence he's in the photo, and it's our friend Mark Lewis.
That's so funny. Wild.
I want him to wear those badges next time he comes to the fest.
Yes.
I know, and we were talking about it, because I've got my badges in that photo as well, and he said he would be meticulous, planning for hours where to position those badges.
Oh, boy, do we have so much material when we talk to Mark next.
It's a good photo.
He was only 42 at the time.
Oh, God. Oh, that
and he does
oh,
listen, so I'm glad you said it,
that
not
hurt,
us.
That hurt, Richard. He's going to blame us for that. I know it.
Well,
I hope so, yeah.
But you know what? The one thing that did strike me is after reading Mark's book, you find out that the Beatles moved so much around Liverpool that, you know, when you see the four houses that they pass off as the Beatles' birthplaces or whatever, it's really not. It becomes a little less significant.
Well, John and Paul's houses are.
Yeah,
they're part of the National
but even,
Trust.
But even Paul moved.
Everybody moved so many times.
The fourth room.
They did.
The one that you see that's on the National Trust, that was
fourth
their
road.
Fourth room. That was 56.
Right.
And before that, they had moved a couple of times. Yeah, but the 56 one, that's where his dad lived for a long time afterwards.
And actually, when I was there in 2012, that's when I did go and do the National Trust. And wouldn't it be the National Trust, like Happiness is a Warm Gun?
Oh.
The National Trust now runs the tours. And so I did see inside Mendip's and Paul's home at Fourth Lynn Road. And that's just an amazing experience for anyone who hasn't done that. They really should do that.
No pictures allowed inside, though.
No pictures allowed inside. That's why I've only got pictures from the outside.
Yeah, I had the same thing.
Well, they should also. Yeah. I really believe that they should have kept up 3 Savile Row. Unfortunately, now it's going to be an Abercrombie and Fitch or whatever it is now. When I went there, it was like a builder's trust company or whatever it was in 96. But it's. I know now, you look back in hindsight and say, oh, I should have collected this, I should have collected that. And maybe that's the same thing for that building. To tell you the truth, yes, it was 3 Savile Row, but Apple was a bunch of places prior to that.
Yes.
And now, obviously, Ovington Square. But so that was the place that you remember because of the rooftop concert and such. But I wish it would have been kept up.
I took Richard Porter's tour when I was in London, I was if you don't know Richard, last year I was in London visiting my sister, and I went to Liverpool also.
And it'll Richard never be the same again.
It never will. He takes you down Savile Row. And I think the building next door sort of looks like old Apple, while the building that had Apple's totally been redone, including the roof.
Yeah, I know.
But I think the building next door is pretty close to it.
Yeah.
So it's
it's there was that gathering. I wasn't there a few years ago on the roof at 3 Savile Row, and I think it was before they redid it. And they even had the cop, the young cop who's in the Let It Be film.
Oh, how cool. That's fine.
He was back up there as well, giving, you know, his memories. That would have been cool to be there.
I still like that woman in Let It Be when it's just not, what did she say?
It's something like, it just doesn't make sense.
Yeah, she's
doesn't make sense.
It just doesn't make sense. Yeah.
And I love the old guy who I quote in the book.
Yes.
The one, yes, I said, you know, old Cockney, fantastic.
Yeah, don't tell people. Let people have something to read in this book called
There's
Beatles 101.
There's a lot more to read. We didn't
There's a lot
touch.
To read. We didn't. I mean, I'm just flipping through. And I'm just smiling over it. I mean, I love the subtitling.
Well, yeah.
And again, it's the humor, and it's the idea too that this is a story that takes you in a lot of different directions. And there's controversy. I like the fact that you sort of bring in the chapter by saying not much to smile about in this upcoming chapter, folks. But yet there is consistently, you know, the section about you know, the two Virgins album is called Bare Assets.
Yes.
And but there is really a well put together and concise feel to
but
it.
But as Richard said, though, you can go from page 52. To page 185, and it's okay because, you know, you can find out so many different things. You didn't miss anything because you can go back to the parts.
Right.
And the only thing that's done chronologically, I will say, is chapter 26, where it's Can I Have a Little More, the Beatles anthology.
Right.
Yes. That's at the end.
Yeah, well, because you're telling this, but it's also, again, a specific snapshot
Correct.
Story.
Right. But other than that, you
can
flip
and
through
the back, and the timeline, which is great to have as an appendix. That was a great idea too, Richard, just to add the whole timeline in literally as the appendix.
Right. And you know, with the humor, I mean, that's a part of me, you know, but I always think of George talking about Within You, Without You, and when he was asked about why there's laughter at the end of the track.
Yes.
And he said, because ultimately, don't take any of it too seriously.
Right.
You know, just don't take anything too seriously here. And I think Mark mentions that in his very generous, you know, mention of me in his book.
Yeah.
Mark Lewison, where he basically talks about how the two of us share and have shared for many years a lot of laughs about the Beatles. You know, we're always, you know, there's so much, there is a lot of humor in that story.
Absolutely.
And their humor, of course, that runs through everything. So that's why I enjoy writing a book like Beatles 101 and being able to inject it with that humor. What we haven't talked about was a section of the book which focuses on Mitch when he was an Apple Scruff.
Oh, I still am. I go around all the time with my albums waiting for Paul to go back into the studio.
And the kids used to laugh at him.
Yeah, that was back when he was Michelle, actually. I'm sorry.
The little children laughed at him behind his back. That's where the line came from.
Not only was it transcribed.
Didn't you do those high backing vocals on Across the Universe?
Yes, after I became the eunuch, I was able to do every single. That's me.
That was it. Was you and little Malcolm and the eunuch? Sorry.
No, said little Nicole.
Little Malcolm. And
I want to say something because you've been asking for British perspective and stuff.
Yes.
Something that Mark and I say this not in a condescending way, but just, you know, really genuine, that Mark and I love talking with American Beatle experts. We just love that. We love, you know, the knowledge, because you know, we met a lot of Americans, got real great in-depth
knowledge. And then you guys call each other on the phone and laugh.
And laugh at us. Did you hear what Mitch said?
No, really, you know, it's really impressive, and it's also great that you guys get to know, you know, this is a great achievement of the Beatles, is that they exported their English culture to the world.
Yes,
there's been
absolutely.
A lot of American culture that's obviously gone over to the UK, and it's nice to see it go the other way so that you guys have heard about Mrs. Mills, for instance, you know, or whoever, but, you know, some names that Americans would never normally know about because of the Beatles. You guys know these names, and we just love that.
I mean, even down to things like Terry Southern, and of course, to look back at, I mean, I never ever would have looked at the Goons. For me, one of my favorite things is The Scaffold. And I know as much as Mike wanted to try to pull himself away from, you know, I don't want to just be Paul's brother. Truth be told, I probably never would have gone over to The Scaffold had there not been the Beatles connection.
Right.
And found what wonderful humor and, you know, and stuff.
And, you know, even that you've heard of the names Morecambe and Wise, who were comedy legends in the UK. And Magical Mystery Tour, which has just got a lot of Britishness to it.
Right.
Well, you know, there's a lot of old music hall artists in that film, and just you're getting some of the influences that the Beatles grew up with. You know, that kind of bus tour to go and see the lights at Blackpool, as they said. There's a lot of Britishness to that, and it's just wonderful. And we just love hearing, you know, the American Beatle experts talking about that.
Well, thank you.
One thing I will say to Anthony, and I want you to look this up. You and Kathy, when you were doing Beatle tracks, did a great interview with Mike McCartney. McGeer.
Yeah.
Was it McGeer then?
And we were
I wish the Tony Torquato archives can open up and grab that out.
Okay, I will find that. We spent about an hour and a half with Mike, and he talked about stuff he'd never spoken about before.
The thing about that was, I remember he knew you guys knew your crap.
Yeah, well, we had fun. We were talking about Scaffold with him. It made his brain hurt.
Yeah, so.
But
okay, let's end the show.
One more thing. The other thing, too, Richard, that was cool was that, you know, if you think about it, and this is bandied about a lot, but they also brought things back. They brought our American culture back to us.
Yeah.
I mean, I wouldn't have gone as deep probably into, as a white kid from
Motown,
Long Island, I probably wouldn't have gone as heavily into looking at Barrett Strong.
Or
Arthur Alexander, who is God. I mean,
Little
that guy's amazing.
Richard, Buddy Holly. Carl Perkins.
Had it not been for the Beatles.
Yeah, the history of their music.
And you know, the sheer artistic nerve that they had. You know, Mark and I, when iTunes put out the Washington Coliseum concert, you know, the full one, and I was at Mark's place, we were watching it, and the end of that concert, where they end with Long Tall Sally and Twist and Shout, and here are the Beatles and their first American show, bringing back to America American music
and they
in
open
their
up,
form.
But they open up with Roll Over Beethoven.
Yeah.
I know. And you know, that takes a lot of nerve. We're kind of used to that now. But, I mean, my God, you know, they could have fallen on their faces trying to do that.
True.
And
very true.
Fantastic to have that on film.
Yeah. By the way, if you watch that concert, Ringo is just on speed.
On
I mean, I'm not saying he literally on speed, but he's doing fills.
Fire.
If you ever want to see Ringo at his best as a drummer, and people give him
crap. No pun intended.
Yeah, people give him crap about drumming. He was, you know, John Paul George and the Lucky One.
Yeah,
he smokes. He does fills in every song that are not on the record.
Right.
Absolutely. And I think also that concert, we capture the Beatles at their height as a performing band.
I agree.
You know, they've learned it all in Hamburg and in Liverpool. And they're so tight. And we catch them in that concert where their enthusiasm is also at a peak.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, it's not the, you know, three-hour Hamburg performance. It's, you know, the
and
much
it's not
shorter
the
show.
Japan performance. I mean, come on, let's face it.
Well, you talk about Ringo, juxtapose that performance with him in Japan.
Poor thing.
Do we have to?
poor thing. It looks like he hasn't had a good meal or a good
Stupper,
good crap in a week.
And we know that's not true.
All right, come on, let's go.
Well, Richard, we thank you for joining us today on the Fab Four Free-for-All. Of course, we've been talking to Richard Buskin, the author of Beatles 101, The Need to Know Guide, published by Parading Press.
Books are good, but parading's better.
Sorry. Is that what that
means? I hate your accent.
What's that?
I don't like your accent.
And we went basically the whole show without Tony doing an accent. You know, he's got a real British guy on the phone.
I'll sod off, Rob Leonard, will you?
Was that me?
No, I said so.
well, it could have been, actually.
No.
Not in your dreams.
No, that wasn't.
You are not in our dreams, Rob Leonard. Sorry.
No, you. If you heard Tony's accent, it would be
nice.
Yeah, it's sort of nightmare.
Run away.
Anyway, I've been your moderator today, Rob Leonard, and joining me as always is
Tony Chiguardo
and
Mitch Axelrod.
And our guest has been
Richard Buskin.
And we hope to have you on again soon, Richard.
We
know you do Beatles 102, 3, and 4 because you're going to copy Mark, right? And you're just going to take this one's only, but you're going to do one every 10 years, right?
Yes. The next volume is going to be taking you back up to the year 2525. Okay?
It's always back to Zager and Evans.
And we've got to have you guys on something about the Beatles as well.
Definitely.
That would be really...
Mention your podcast again. You and Rodriguez do what?
Something About the Beatles. It's a podcast that's fortnightly, and just two guys chatting about their first love.
All right, can I just say one thing? As Americans, I know you're in Chicago now, but fortnightly is not really cutting it for us.
Every 2 weeks, Mitch.
Thank you. Well, you say a fortnight, and we're all like, what? What? Do I have to go look that up?
I think of someone holding a candle.
Come on, you never heard the Beatles say fortnight?
Yes, but I've never heard you say it. So
it's been a hard day's fortnight. Come on, Mitch, get it straight.
So every 2 weeks they had
every
the film?
Every 2 weeks they had the film.
Thank you.
Anyway, Richard, thank you for coming on. We appreciate it.
And please go buy his book.
Guys.
Buy the book.
We appreciate it.
Thanks, now.
Fab 4 Free-for-All was edited and produced by Tony Triguardo at Word of Mouth Studios in Westbury, New York.
The opening and closing theme is My Dolly by the band The Badge, featuring longtime listener Jeff Slate, available on its debut album Digital Retro and recent Best Of compilation, as well as from the Fab 4 Free-for-All website.
Thanks for listening to Fab 4 Free-for-All.
Seven minutes. I'll be right back. I'm going to the loo.
So,
that's great.
Oh, my God. When Rob said that, he's like, we'll call you back in 7 minutes. We have to read your book.
I'm
like,
we were cracking up on the other side of the glass.
I said, I hope he's laughing because
he was.
All of a sudden you hear click.
Too much.
It's okay. I'm used to it.
Oh.
How's it
going there, Richard?
Yeah, I'm fine. Hanging in there. How about you guys?
We're okay. The same. By the way, I heard it took Lewison only 5 minutes to read the book.
Yeah, I know. keep them coming.
That's what my wife says to me every day.
That's a great picture of Mark and you in front of a strawberry field.
Oh, that's such a great
Isn't that
shot.
Amazing? We actually didn't know each other at that time.
Really?
You know, we sort
really?
Of, yeah, we saw each other. We weren't friends, put it that way. We became friendly, I think, like later that year.
Oh, how funny.
So you just happened to have a picture of the two of you in the same spot?
That's really
exactly.
cool, man.
Exactly. And it was like years later that I sort of came upon it, you know, and went, wow, that's him. I can't believe
it. Were you guys
that's
on a tour so cool. together? Were you on...
Yeah, it was... It was the, let me think, something like the second Liverpool convention, Beatles convention, and it was organized by Alan Williams and Bob Wooler. How good does it get? And we were all on different tour buses. My tour bus, the guide was Beryl Williams, Alan's wife.
Yeah, well, that's
And I remember at one point, there's a photo in the book of Mona Best.
Yeah, not a very flattering picture, by the way.
So that was in the garden there, you know, the backyard of her house, and Alan Williams was hiding because he had described her in The Man Who Gave the Beatles Away as a mean and volatile woman.
Oh, God. He was a little bitter.
Oh.
Just bring Richard down just a hair.
No, his
bring him down
level.
Just a hair. Your book is not that good. Did I bring you down a hair?
No, the podcast
starting
isn't good.
With taking 7 minutes to read it. How can you bring me down a hair?
That was Rob. I don't have much hair to give, so I'm not doing it.
They're our competition with the podcast world, damn it.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, but we all have a way to go. Come on, Rob, you ready?
I'm
you got
ready.
Levels?
We got levels.
Time out.
We got levels.
Are you going to die? Because if you die on radio, this will be the biggest ratings we ever get.
Biggest ratings
be like Jack Spector dying.
Wow. And Richard then will put in Beatles 102.
Richard will just take my place.
You know,
from Chicago, Richard could just be...
You know, that's not a bad idea.
Wow.
You're our Clapton.
Beatles 102. Now, there's a good
Tony time. Dies on... You know, that'll be an addition to your book. By the way, the Fab Four Free-for-All, Tony died on the episode that I was on.
He was choking on Pringles.
Tony choked on his own Liverpudlian.
Every week, believe me. Either that or we do. Oh, my God.
That was good.
Oh, yes, it was, but unlike your accent.
True. We'll have an accent off later.
There we go.
Okay, let's
that
get ready.
That just sounded dirty.
Yes, it did.
All right, now we have to be serious.
Do we have levels?
We have levels.
We have levels.